differential discrimination training techniques. So, different ways of doing this. So we've given some of the sort of background on this, what's going on, but let's take a look at some of the different ways to actually implement here. Presence-absence training. This is probably the most straightforward, most basic, most like the longest, most commonly used for the longest period of time approach to things. So, in presence-absence, not surprisingly, it says, you know, in the presence of this thing, do this. In the absence of this, something else is going to happen. So, two sort of subsets of these. First is called successive discrimination training. You have an S plus and an S minus. Remember, in the presence of the S plus, you make a response, you're going to get this more reinforcing outcome. In the presence of the S minus, you make a response, you get a less reinforcing outcome. That less reinforcing outcome, maybe nothing happens at all, or maybe something aversive happens, but that's definitely less, it's the less appetitive. All right. So what happens here in successive discrimination, successive one after another? So randomly, you're going to be presented with the S plus or the S minus, and then these are just going to alternate over however many training trials there are. Simultaneous discrimination training, on the other hand, we've got our S plus and our S minus, again, so some discriminative stimuli, they're presented at the same time. So here's a yellow light and a green light, same time. Which you going to pick? Okay. Pretty basic, pretty straightforward, easy to implement. You can use classical conditioning as well, right? Here's a CS plus that leads to 10 grams of food. Here's a CS plus that leads to 3 grams of food. Or here's a CS plus that leads to 10 grams of food. Here's a CS minus that leads to no food. Okay, so whatever. And you can either present these successively or simultaneously. Other approaches. Matching to sample. In this case here, developed initially by people that worked with principally pigeons, but it can be applied with lots of other species, including humans. These little round circles are meant to represent what are called key lights. Key lights are little buttons that have a light, little plastic buttons on the wall of an operant chamber that have a little light bulb behind them, so they can be lit up in different colors. It can be white, it can be, you know, green, red, blue, whatever color you can. You can put a little plastic filter in there to make the key sort of glow in this particular color. So during training, there's boom, 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 3 key lights arranged on the wall, and the middle one will light up with, just in this example, a green light. Okay, so we go through our training, and then we switch into the testing period, and now what happens in testing? 3 lights again, 3 little key lights on the wall, but now all of them light up. In this example here, there's a red on the left, green in the middle, and green on the right. Now, the green in the middle gives a prompt saying match. So, matching to sample. Our green in the middle is our sample. If you're a pigeon and you peck at the key in the middle, you won't get reinforced. You only get reinforced by now. The only ones that are going to work are the outside keys. So if it's green in the middle, you need to pick green. So pick one on the right. In another trial, maybe the green and the red are reversed. So it's green on the left, red on the right. Okay, but again, what's in the middle? Green, find the green one. So you're matching. You can do mismatching to sample. Really the same thing, except now it's like avoid whatever's in the middle. So if green's in the middle, ooh, find the red one. Do not peck the thing that's in the middle. Do not peck the sample. Okay? Just different techniques that are used to train up to do discrimination training. Okay? There's also a delayed matching to sample. So we go through our training, and what's in the middle, respond to that. Then what happens is once we switch to testing, the only the middle key is lit up with whatever color it is. Let's say green. So, boop, there's the green in the middle. That's presented for whatever, a few seconds, 5 seconds, 10 seconds. Then it's turned off. for some period of time. All of the keys go blank. That's called the delay period. Could be a second, could be 10 seconds, could be 16 hours, whatever it is. And then you get the outside lights that come up, nothing in the middle. And so basically you have to remember, what did you see before the delay period? Pick that. So this one is really beloved by psychologists, behavioral psychologists, cognitive psychologists that are interested in issues of learning and memory. So can you remember short-term, long-term memories, these sorts of things? So this, the delayed matching of sample is a test of, you know, how long can you remember? Okay, so these are just different techniques for doing this, for setting up discrimination training. And those are pretty straightforward. They're pretty basic. They're pretty easily implemented. The thing with them is that they're not always, I guess what you'd say, the best for actually doing the conditioning, doing the training. If you really want to be precise, you really want to get a particular response out of a subject, and you really want it to happen quickly, there are better techniques to use. And one of these is called errorless discrimination. So all of the other ones I just discussed there, successive, simultaneous, the matching to samples, these take kind of a long time to train up. The discrimination learning takes a while. Part of the issue is that because we've got a trial and error process happening, there's no shaping going on here, right? The subjects will not uncommonly make the wrong choice. It's like, okay, I saw green before, what happens if I press red? Oh, nothing. Right, but then they'll try it some more. Maybe they're confused, maybe they don't remember, maybe it's just shiny, peck, whatever it happens to be, or a rat, that looks interesting, push, 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 whatever it happens to be. Okay, so make mistakes when the S minus is selected, so when you get the less reinforcing option. That happens in the previous ones I've discussed. In errorless discrimination, you make it very hard for the subjects to make a mistake. So what you do is you present your S plus as normal, but you present your S minus at a very low salience and for a very short period of time. So let's just say we've got, let's do this with a successive approximation, errorless discrimination. So they're going to be presented one at a time. So the S plus comes on, green light, it comes on for 10 seconds, and it's a 60-watt green light bulb. Okay, 10 seconds, 60. If you press the lever during that time, you get some food. All right? S minus. First time the S minus is presented, we will present it for half a second, in a 2-watt light bulb, right? So it's like, would something happen? Ooh, I saw a light. Oh, too late. It's gone. Did I really see a light? So it's really tough to make a response to the S minus. Now, what you gradually do is you ramp this up. Then after maybe 10 or 15 presentations, here where the S minus is at 2 watts for half a second, we step up. You know, we've got a 5-watt bulb and present it for a second. Okay. Now remember, all this time, our subject has also been getting the S plus, our 60-watt bulb in green, for 10 seconds. Really easy to respond to. So it's getting a lot of training, respond to green. By the time it's really got the opportunity where our red light is on at like 30 watts for 6 seconds, it's had so much exposure to the green that it's probably not going to respond to the red very much at all. Maybe it goes, what happens? Nothing? Nothing. Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay? So this is called errorless discrimination. By doing this, we can actually get pretty quick discrimination training. It's actually quite rapid. And we get relatively little frustration. This seems to be a big thing. So one of the things, by picking an S minus, in the other cases where it's more equal in terms of presentation strength, salience, time, if you press the S minus, oh, I didn't get anything. You might get frustrated. If you're frustrated, you may be so focused on, oh, I lost, that you miss what's going on. Oh, here's an S plus. Oh, damn, I missed it. I was so busy being pissed off that I didn't get the S, I didn't get the reinforcer when I pressed the red light, that I also missed the green light. This sucks, right? So if we can reduce the overall frustration, it's a lot easier. Seems to, doesn't interfere with the learning. So this is a technique that's actually often utilized with people if you need very specific discrimination training. All right. Another way that this can be done, which can lead to some very specific stimulus control, is to utilize what's called a differential outcomes effect. In this case here, different reinforcers are available for different responses. So it's not always, in the presence of stimulus, make this response, get food. In the presence of this stimulus, make this response, get food. It could be in the presence of this stimulus, make this response, get some water. In the presence of this stimulus, make this response, get some food. In the presence of this stimulus, make this response, get tickled with a feather. Whatever it happens to be. So we have different outcomes. Right? So we have different reinforcers. Essentially, what we're doing here is, in the process of doing this discrimination training, we are setting up, we are conditioning stimulus control for multiple three-term contingencies. Again, you could do this with classical conditioning as well. Just use multiple CSs with different USs. What's nice about this is you can it can produce some relatively fast, strong discrimination training. So this works faster, and the conditioning tends to be stronger than with our basic forms. One of the things here is once you start conditioning the idea that you have to make a response in the presence of a stimulus, that concept of responding generalizes. Okay, so as opposed to, you know, do all of them together, and the subject still is going, oh yeah, I have to do something to get something, whether or not it's the same response doesn't even really matter. You can even do something a little more funky where you've got, in the presence of this stimulus, if I pull this chain, I get food. In the presence of this other stimulus, if I push this button, I get water. In the presence of this third stimulus, if I slide a lever over, I get tickled by the feather, whatever it was. Okay? Once they just first start to get the idea, oh yeah, I respond, I get something, that little bit of learning generalizes, even if you're doing different responses. So you can train up a lot of things more rapidly this way. Again, if we're working with rats and pigeons, you know, it's not that big of a deal. We got a lot of time with the rats and pigeons. But if you're working in, say, a workforce or in a school setting, right, there's a limited amount of time that you've got access to work with people to do the training. So anything that can be done to speed things up here can be quite advantageous. We haven't really talked much about theory on this. We should probably do that a little bit here, so we'll go through a few theories. As I said, well, I've been talking primarily about using my examples with respect to operant contingencies. This can be done with classical conditioning, Pavlovian conditioning as well. So, not surprisingly, we go back to Pavlov. Pavlov had some ideas about how stimulus control, discrimination, and generalization was working in classical conditioning. He certainly knew that it worked. He was aware of this. Now, as I said, Pavlov was really a medical physiologist. He really wasn't a psychologist. Wasn't a psychiatrist. He was a physician. So he was a research physician. So because of this, he tended to think of things in terms of these very core biological processes. For various reasons, and again, you got to remember that Pavlov's doing this at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, and by today's standards, the ability to understand species differences, neurological differences, similarities, and why they occurred in species basically was crap. Okay, by today's standard, it's almost like you're using stone tools to do stuff. So quite, you know, time really advanced, but by today's standards, quite primitive. We kind of forget these things. So, I mean, didn't even really know what most of the regions of the brain actually did, let alone how the neurons actually interacted to produce memories or learning or changes in synaptic strength, all of these things. Certainly couldn't take electrical potentials from neurons. Okay, so by working with different species, Pavlov comes to the conclusion that different species can learn different things more easily. Well, if we take a look at this, he finds, for example, dogs are colorblind. They lack one of the cones that humans have, and so they see colors in a different way. Based upon that, say, oh, dogs are going to, you know, they're going to generalize and discriminate different from humans. All right. So Pavlov says, yeah, well, there's going to be a species influence there. We've talked about species-specific defense reactions. Different species will respond to different stimuli in different ways. Okay, so he says, yeah, there's probably differences with different species in terms of what they're going to learn, how they're going to learn it. He says, what's probably happening here, and again, remember, he can't go into the brain and actually record electrical potentials from neurons. He can't map brain activity with ERPs or CAT scans or magnetic resonance imaging. He's got none of this stuff. So he's having to do these huge inferences here, but he says, what's probably happening is that during discrimination training, there's going to be different areas in the brain that get activated. So there's going to be some part of the brain that's involved in, say, a CS+. So if you present this CS+, an excitatory conditional stimulus, this will activate the excitatory conditioning regions of the brain, wherever those happen to be. If you have a CS-, those will activate the inhibitory parts of the brain. Again, wherever those might be. Somewhere in there has to be something that's excitatory and inhibitory. You say, well, how do you come to that conclusion? Well, it's not actually a terrible idea to make. In fact, we do know that nowadays the neurons work on a lot of these sort of opposites. We have excitatory and inhibitory neurotransmitters. So these dualities or binaries are quite reasonable. Pavlov said that if you've trained with a particular CS+, an excitatory conditional stimulus, this will activate a particular part of the brain that is associated with that stimulus in the excitatory region. He said then if you are going to present other stimuli, you never trained with them, you present another stimulus, the more similar that stimulus is to the trained stimulus, you will get generalization because it will be physically activating a part of the brain in close physical proximity to that CS plus area of the brain that you already trained with. So he figured that the generalization is going to be due to essentially sort of a, if you will, bleed over effect in the brain. If they're close together, you know, things that are close together are more likely to be deactivated. Physical proximity was what involved. And again, this is, given what was known at the time, this was not a hugely bizarre concept to come up with, right? You know, you've all seen probably the pictures of, you know, the cross-section of the brain where it's like, big lips and the teeth, the mouth and the tongue and all this, and huge hands and all of this sort of thing. So, yeah, I mean, the parts of your cortex there, they're dealing with fingers, are in close proximity and so on. So, you know, you knew that much at least from cases where there'd been damage. People had strokes or taken other damage to the brain. So they had some idea that proximity was significant, at least for some perceptual processes. He said, the more dissimilar a stimulus is, the further away it's going to be from the CS that you trained with, the less likely it is to activate that region. Consequently, if it doesn't activate that region, you're not going to get a conditional response. No conditional response, that would be discrimination. Okay. So, nice, wrong, but nice. Unfortunately, the brain doesn't actually quite work that way. Another problem with this one is it's really quite an inferential theory generated really from observed behavior. If you're going to generate inferentially based theories, you need to go back and then come up with ways to specifically empirically test your inferences. Your inferences should at least make different sorts of predictions that can be tested there. Unfortunately, when subsequent people did this, they weren't able to validate this interpretation of Pavlov. So, interesting theory at the time, historically, you know, important to at least contextualize this and think about how science works and moves forward and theory generation is produced, but we now know that Pavlov was wrong in this case. All right. So, next theory on discrimination, training, generalization discrimination comes in from a guy called Spence. So we're into the 1940s now. Spence utilized what was called an opponent process theory. I often think that if I were to ever write a textbook on this subject, I wouldn't do it by sort of, well, it gets difficult how you can do this, but I often think chronologically it would be an interesting way to do things because, for example, in the 1940s, we start to see opponent process theories coming in, ideas that things work in opposition, right? We've already seen this, I mean, the ideas with compensatory conditional responses, right? You've got a CR that does this, and then you've got a UR that's going to do that. Will they work in opposition, or will they synchronize? Okay, so opponent process theories are actually quite prevalent in behavioral psychology, learning psychology, starting in sort of the 40s and 50s and continuing on. Anyways, so this is what Spence is doing. He's utilizing these opponent process theories. He says, look, you're going to have excitatory, be it a CS+ or an S+, so classic or operant, and inhibitory, be it CS- or S-, you're going to have excitatory and inhibitory gradients in the brain. Now, keep in mind, he's not talking about physical locations like Pavlov was. By this point, right, psychologists know there's electrical activity in the brain, it activates different parts of the brain, seem to be activated, this starts to explain things like epileptic effects, starting to get an idea of neurotransmitter differences. Okay, so we've progressed here. A few decades have made huge differences in theorizing about how the brain actually learns and regulates behaviors. So Spence says, right, let's say that we've got excitatory and inhibitory, he just calls them gradients. That means excitatory and inhibitory activation is going on somehow in parts of the brain. So the behavior that is produced is going to be due to the net sum effect of the gradients. So we've got some amount of excitation, some amount of inhibition. If you add the excitation with the inhibition, if you get a value greater than zero, there will be some behavior occurring. If there is more inhibition, think of these as positive and negative numbers, okay? Simple way to think of these. If you've got more excitation, a higher positive number. If you've got no inhibition at all, great, lots of excitation happening. If you have strong excitation and some inhibition, 10 plus minus 7, you'll still get some excitation, you'll still get some of the behavior, but it will be weaker. If you've got more inhibition than excitation, you won't get a behavioral response. Okay, so that's what's involved in the resultant behavior. Will it occur or not? One of the things that's kind of neat about Spence's interpretation here is it's able to explain a rather odd phenomenon that people were discovering in the 1930s, early 1940s. It's called peak shift. I haven't talked about this yet today. Peak shift is a very specific, odd little change that occurs when you look at generalization gradients under certain types of training situations. Okay, so I've shown you some little hypothetical pictures of generalization gradients, and you know, they look like little mountains, or there's a peak there, there's a peak level of responding. Okay. Peak shift is when the peak level of responding moves away from the S plus in the direction of the S minus, or away from the CS plus in the direction of the CS minus. Okay, I will explain this, but that's your little definition. Okay, if you like having little definitions, we'll go with that. All right, I will now take you through and explain what this means. I'll show you some visuals, and we'll work our way through this. Basically, what peak shift is saying is when you do presence absence training, So if you condition, if you do your training with an S plus and an S minus, you will find that you get the most responding not to your S plus, but to a slightly different stimulus. The peak level of responding has shifted away from the stimulus that you trained from. Weird, right? You would expect that it would be the thing that you trained with, but it's a little bit different. Only happens when you do presence-absence training, okay? So, here's a way of looking at this. So let's say we've trained with some S+, and our x-axis here on the bottom will represent the stimulus continuum, whatever it is, lights, tones, whatever it happens to be, okay? So we can say that would be our S+ on this continuum. Okay, if we do a control group, so we will, our control group, we will only train subjects with our S+. In the presence of the S+, if you respond, then we will go and do either extinction blocks or probe trials, try out a bunch of different stimuli, and we'll see what the responding will be. And we'll probably get something more or less like this. All right? And here we go. We see that the maximum amount of responding is, in fact, to our S+. Great. No peak shift. But let's do a second group where we have an S+ and an S-, so presence-absence training. Okay? In this case here, we find that the peak level of responding, so there's our peak right there, does not line up with our S+ stimulus. Our peak has moved away from the S+ in the direction opposite to the S-. Okay, so if this were, we're using tones and decibels, right? If this is if our S+ is an 8 decibel tone and our S- is a 10 decibel tone, we find that we have more responding to maybe a 7 decibel tone than to our 8 decibel tone. Our S- was over on this side. Our peak was shifted this way. Okay? So that's the peak shift. Now, how do we explain this? Oops, there's our shift direction. Spence, this is where Spence's idea comes in. We have excitatory and inhibitory gradients. So, up top, I've got the net gradient. The behavior is going to be due to the addition, if you will, of the excitation and the inhibition. All right, so let's say that we've got an S+. We're going to do presence-absence training. So there's our S+. Now, let's say that our S+ generates a particular excitatory gradient. It should probably really be some sort of Gaussian function. Gaussian functions are really hard to draw in with PowerPoint, so I'm just going to cheat and make this nice little sort of, you know, pyramidal gradients here. All right, so let's say, now keep in mind, we're dealing with quite hypothetical numbers at this point. So I will say that when you present the S+ after training, in the presence of the S+, there are 15 units of excitation. What's a unit of excitation? Can you pour it in a beaker and show it to me? No, I can't. It's a construct. All right? I mean, I suppose you could correlate this with, you know, microliters of dopamine or something, but I'm not even going to bother trying, all right? We're just saying 15 units of excitation. Just to make things simple, let's stick an S- in here. So we're doing presence-absence training. In the presence of the S-, if you respond, you're going to get the something lesser, probably no reinforcement here at all. And let's just make it easy and say that in the presence of the S- produces negative 15 units. So it's got 15 units of inhibition. All right? If you only present the S-, you will get no behavioral response. If you only present the S+, you will get a fairly strong behavioral response. What happens when we present various other stimuli? Well, various other stimuli on our stimulus continuum are going to be not just more or less similar to our S plus, but also more or less similar to our S minus. So, if we took a stimulus over way over on this side, it's at this point quite far away, quite dissimilar to our S minus, so we don't get any inhibition coming in. The only thing it's like is our S plus. If we took a stimulus way over here, so that it was so stunningly dissimilar from anything we trained with, we probably wouldn't get any responding whatsoever. There'd be no excitation at all, nothing. Your subject just go, I don't know what the heck that is. I'm not doing anything. Okay? And in fact, we find that empirically. If you pick something that's so incredibly different, the subject just goes, yeah, I'm not responding to that at all. That's clearly something I shouldn't be responding to. Okay, so to get the net gradient, the net sum effect, for each stimulus that we're going to test with, we add up the amount of, we take the amount of excitation, add it to the amount of inhibition. Let's just assume these are positive and negative values. So let's take the amount here at the S plus. So we present the S plus. Now the S plus stimulus is exactly like the S plus, but it's also, to a greater or lesser degree, shares some commonalities with our S minus. Okay, so we add them together. At the point of the S plus, we have 15 units of excitation and minus 10 units of inhibition. So 15 minus 10 is 5. Blunk, let's pop a dot there on our net gradient. Let's take over here. At the S minus, there are 10 units of excitation and minus 15 units of inhibition, which should give us minus 5, right? But you can't have less behavioral responding than no behavioral responding at all. I'm making even less of a response than no response. Nope. So we'll put a dot at 0. Okay? Now, if you were to go through and do this with all the other little points here, all the other little stimuli, we would start to see something like this. At this point here, all we've got is excitation, but now our dots start to curve here. We've got some inhibition coming in. And we find this pattern. Notice our peak level of responding is not at the S plus. Let's consider. So if I were to draw a line down, we've got like maybe, I don't know, 13 and a half units of excitation at this point, if we had this stimulus here on the continuum, and we've got like maybe, seven and a half units of inhibition. Okay, so we're going to get something greater than 5. Spence's theory does a great job accounting for this, explaining peak shift. Beautiful. Very nice job here. Let's run this up for a second here, get this out of the way. What if we did something like this? Got an S plus here, S minus here. Okay? I have some excitation over here. I have some inhibition over here. What's our generalization gradient going to look like? Well, let's see. For a stimulus over here, there's no inhibition, so actually we're going to do we get a teeny bit of inhibition here. Is there a peak shift? I didn't draw this well. I'm supposed to have this flat up here, okay. But is there a peak shift? Our peak hasn't really shifted. There's a little bit of a drop off on our tail. Really, not much. They're so different that they don't overlap. What if instead I did something like this? Okay. There's our S plus. to an S minus. You haven't seen that. There's another S minus.
What do you think we're going to
get?
Let's make this even easier. Let's move our S minus a little bit further out.
Okay.
Well, we've got some excitation here. We've got some inhibition over there.
Present some stimulus over here. No excitation, plenty of some inhibition, so nothing. We move in. Okay, we start to get some excitation here, but oh look, we've got a heck of a lot of inhibition, so still nothing. What we're going to get is an extreme. What about right here at the middle? Is there any inhibition? Nope, all we got is excitation. So we'll get a point there. What we will get is an extremely narrow generalization gradient. So this is what Spence's theory predicts. This is, in fact, what we find. All right? Our peak hasn't shifted, per se, but the tails have been canceled out by these inhibitory S minuses. Right? So, again, these are the predictions that we made from the theory, and we do, in fact, actually find those. All right, so, yeah, there's our difference between our S plus and the peak. There we go. All right, now, that's great. So we can get these sorts of predictions that work. The excitatory inhibitory gradients that Spence talks about, they're kind of inferential constructs. Do we have any actual evidence that they really do kind of exist? Actually, yeah, we do have some. Some work by Honig, a Canadian psychologist, actually, passed away a few years back. Honig loved working with pigeons, really preferred pigeons over anything else. So set this up. His first group of pigeons here had used key lights. The S plus was a key light with a vertical black bar on it. The S minus is a just blank key light. And then, so he went through the training, presence-absence training, and then, for testing, presented pigeons with a whole bunch of different orientations of a bar, going from vertical down to horizontal. Found this kind of response pattern. The pigeons responded a lot to the vertical, because that's what they were trained on, and very little to the others. Now, you go, wait a minute, where's the peak shift? Ah, well, keep in mind, he's using a vertical bar as the S plus and a blank key light as an S minus. If he had used, say, a 45 degree angled bar as the S minus, yeah, we would expect there to be a shift over this direction. But in this case, the absence of something doesn't really fit on this continuum, so we actually don't have a shift, which is kind of an interesting little thing that, yeah, you really don't have to worry about too much at this level. But yeah. Here's where it gets interesting. The second group. In the case of the second group, the S plus is a blank key light. The S minus is a vertical bar. Now, for these subjects, they respond like this. So, in the presence of the S minus, they respond very little. Now, they're never presented with the S plus. They're never shown a blank key light. But you look at it this way, you go, oh, okay, here's some discrimination, if you will. The 45 degree bars are still pretty much like the verticals. How about the horizontals? Well, the horizontal bars, they're not a blank key light. But the horizontal is pretty different from the vertical. And so they respond more to the horizontals. Now, they don't respond as much as our group one that responds for our vertical. But in a sense, these look an awful lot like Spence's ideas of excitatory and inhibitory gradients. So there's some evidence that somewhere there in the brain there are these patterns occurring. All right. Last theory to look at here, the Lashley-Wade theory. This one says the generalization gradients are going to depend upon prior experience with stimuli similar to those used in testing. So this is saying your life experience or background experience, this is going to determine how you respond. So Lashley and Waite said, discrimination training leads to discrimination because it teaches the subject to tell the difference between your S plus and any other stimuli that might be encountered. You say, wait a minute, but not everybody exists like a pigeon in a little operant chamber where you're being presented with key lights. And yeah, exactly. But here's the everyday experiences that do this. So everyday experiences produce discrimination learning. Over time, you learn when people smile, that they're happy, and you can perhaps it's a good time to go talk to them about something. If they're frowning, maybe it's a good time to leave that delicate subject alone. All right? So past experience has done this. That's still a bit kind of vague, right? Smiling, frowning, real-world things. Let's make it a little bit, we'll look at things that are a little bit similar, or a little bit simpler here. So we can make some predictions. Out of the Lashley-Waite theory of stimulus control, we can predict that previous experience with stimuli will make discrimination training of these stimuli easier. Lack of prior experience with this type of stimuli set will make subsequent training more difficult. Now, the way to actually study this is to do longitudinal studies with non-human subjects. And what we're going to do is we're going to raise our subjects under different environmental conditions. So here's a very standard, one of the original sort of standard approaches designs have taken. So rear our non-human animal subjects under very specific environmental conditions. So for example, raise some chicks, let the eggs hatch, raise them in darkness. Okay, so they're raised entirely in darkness. No light. Okay? If they're not raised with any light, they're going to have no exposure during development to colors. Then we can give some presence-absence training, discrimination training, where we're training based on color gradients, test for generalization gradient. Now, what we would expect to happen here is that we're going to get very little discrimination because our hypothetical chicks being raised in absolute darkness have never experienced color. They should do relatively poorly at this when put into training. They will be very bad at discriminating based upon color. If we have a flatter generalization gradient, this would then be support for Lashley-Waite's interpretation. If they can't tell the difference really between them, if they treat everything more or less the same, there we go. And in fact, this was what was being found. So this starts to look very good for Lashley and Waite. But there are some issues. Depending upon the kind of deprivation environment that different subjects were raised under, sometimes got some rather different results. Turns out that there are what are called critical developmental periods in many animals, and if animals are not exposed to particular types of stimuli or stimuli perceptual categories or things during a particular time frame, neurologically, they just do not have the ability to process this material when they become adults. So a study, for example, was done with kittens. After kittens were born, but before they opened their eyes, kittens had little goggles put onto their heads. So cats in goggles, always cute. And what these goggles were is in for half of the subjects, the goggles had vertical black lines on them. For the other half, horizontal black lines. After they were grown-up cats, goggles were removed. What they found was that the adults that had grown up having the vertical bars would tend to make certain mistakes. So they were great at noticing things that were vertical, like chair legs or lampposts or things like that, but they didn't seem to be able to actually see and perceive horizontal things, so they'd walk right off the edge of the table. Conversely, the cats that have been raised with the horizontal lines are able to see table edges, things like that, but they'll walk into trees. It seems that there is a critical developmental period in the visual system of kittens. They are not exposed to certain types of stimuli. Their brain simply doesn't develop the connections to deal with those. So, with our chicks raised in darkness, we have the possibility that the reason that they don't respond to any colors is they may not be able to. Their brains just, during a critical developmental period, didn't develop the color processing section of the visual cortex. Okay, so that's a problem. We need to control. We need to control for that. So here's some work by Jenkins and Harrison, 1960, that does this. First group of pigeons. Have an S plus of tone. Tone leads to reinforcement. S minus, if there's no tone, no reinforcement. So S plus, S minus. Second group of pigeons here. S plus tone leads to reinforcement. No S minus. They don't have any S minus in this case here, because a tone is always on. So in our second case here, there's a tone going all the time, which means anytime they peck, they can get reinforced. The tone never turns off. Now, these pigeons are being raised this way, being reared under these two situations. In the case of our group two pigeons, they've managed to avoid any sort of neurological deficit. If you'd raised them in the complete absence of sound, then perhaps the auditory cortex is not going to develop, so they can't actually distinguish any sounds. But here, there's always a noise. So the auditory cortex is always getting some stimulation. Okay, so we avoid the kind of neurological deficit that's going to happen. Both groups get tested for generalization then to tones and to periods of silence. And we find that our group one birds are less likely to respond during the silent periods. They show what you'd expect, your fairly standard generalization gradient with respect to tones. Okay, no problem there. What about our group two birds here? Well, they respond the same during periods of tone or silence. In other words, they've got a flat discrimination gradient here. Their generalization gradient is more or less the same. They treat everything alike. They've had no exposure to periods of silence, so they've never learned that silent periods mean you may not get something. What have they learned? They've learned you always get something. The little key is always working. You peck it anytime, you will get food. So this supports the Lashley Wade interpretation. Your prior experience makes it hard for our second group of pigeons here to learn the discrimination task. Okay. How do the theories stack up? Pavlov? No, it's out. It's lack of support for Pavlov's interpretation. Okay, poor old Pavlov. A lot of his theories seem to ultimately fail the test of time. But, you know, that's what happens when you're working on things over, you know, 130 years ago, 120 years ago, sort of thing. Sometimes there's going to be changes. How about Spence and Lashley and Wade? Both have got support. So, I mean, for example, Lashley and Wade's interpretation, Lashley and Wade's theory doesn't account for peak shift at all. Really, just like, I don't know, no way of explaining why that happens. Flip side, Spence's theory really has very little to say about exposure to various types of stimuli during development. It's like, I don't know. You're still going to have some sort of excitation inhibition, but meh. So they both got support for various aspects of the deal. What this is sort of telling us is neither theory is a complete theory of stimulus control. All right? What they're saying is that we've got a fairly complex process happening here. We do not yet have the grand unifying theory of stimulus control. In the same way that when we look back at theories about classical conditioning, for example, we didn't have a complete theory there either. Scorlo-Wagner does a good job of explaining some things. Preparedness response theory explains other aspects. It's very difficult to really develop a theory that brings everything together. But, you know, the brain's kind of a complex thing, so maybe we shouldn't be too terribly surprised about that. All right. I'm going to finish this chapter up by looking at a few applications with respect to stimulus control here. Let's talk about concept formation. If you take a cognitive psychology course, you will spend huge amounts of time, I would expect, at least back when I did cognitive psychology courses, we spent lots of time talking about concept formation. Quite interesting. But behavioral psychologists look at these too. But they tend to look at it in terms of stimulus control training. So it's less about sort of meaning, and it's more about how did you acquire that conditioning to begin with. So let's describe a concept as any class of things that share one or more defining features. Now, the defining features, then, are going to be the stimuli that will allow us to discriminate between the objects within a class and outside of a class. These concepts, then, learning psychology, behavioral psychology says, can be acquired through discrimination training. So we're just really dealing with stimulus and control here. So we could have, say, you know, this thing in front of me, chair. Okay, we're going to call it a chair. Why do we define this thing as a chair? Well, it's flat, it's got legs on it, you can sit on it. How about this gizmo over here, the little table thingy? It's flat, I could sit on it, but is it a chair? No, it's a table. Maybe it doesn't have legs. Okay, what outside there, there are some tables that have legs. Okay, so chairs have legs. Tables, many tables have legs. Chairs you can sit on. Tables you can sit on. You see, some of this starts to become rather complicated. My daughter, for example, quite enjoys actually lying on top of our coffee table to watch, you know, the backyardigans or kids' shows. It's like, Grayson, get off the coffee table. It's not for lying on. That's what the couch is for, right over there. It's like, I like this better. Right. Okay. Well, I'm going to put a plate of food on top of the coffee table, and since you're on it, I'll put it on top of you. Good luck eating your snack. Right? You know, right again. Okay, so probably what happens as well here is it's not just the stimuli, but it's how our culture, society, people around us reinforce or punish these things. So again, concept formation through this kind of discrimination training. No, don't do that. Or just to, you know, come back to my daughter, it's, you know, it's like, one of her friends does this, so she started doing this instead of just like drinking from the cup. She's five. She knows how to drink from a cup. It's like, I'm going to stick my hand in the cup of, you know, in the thing of pop and lick it off my hand. It's like, I don't care if your friends do this. We're not doing that here. Why not? Look at your hands. They're filthy. You've just eaten, I don't know, whatever. But you let me lick my hands off when I've got pizza sauce on it. It's like, oh, curse your ability to find holes in my logical argument. Just don't do it, okay? Yeah. Sometimes parents run out of good reasons. Leaving aside the incredibly delightful anecdotal stories of my children, and what an awful father I am, let's go to something that's actually probably a little more scientific. Good old Herrnstein. Remember we did him with respect to choice? He's back with more. So Herrnstein had his grad students run out, gave them cameras, and run out, take pictures of the natural environment. So he had what he called positive and negative instances. Right? So a positive instance is a photograph that has the stimulus. A negative instance is a photograph that doesn't have the stimulus. So let's consider trees. So a picture with a tree in it becomes a positive instance. A picture without a tree becomes a negative instance. So worked with pigeons. 80 pictures. Okay? 40 pictures with trees, 40 pictures without trees. I mean, different trees. He just sent his grad students out, here's a camera, go take pictures on campus. You know, I want pictures with trees and without trees. Fine. Goes through presence-absence training, finds out, not very difficult. The pigeons can do this pretty easily. And then what he does is he tests. Now, he doesn't just show them the same 40 pictures, because maybe it's only 40 pictures of trees, 40 without. Conceivably, the pigeons have just memorized. You know, should you respond? If you respond in the presence of a tree, you get reinforced. If you respond in the presence of a picture without a tree, you don't get reinforced. It could be the pigeons have just memorized every one of these photos and judged. It's like, yeah, I've seen that before. I respond to that. I've seen exactly that. So during the testing, gave them another set of 40 pictures with trees that they'd never seen before, and 40 pictures without trees that they'd never seen before. Okay, no problem. The pigeons are able to respond to the 40 novel trees, and they don't respond to the 40 non-tree situations. So this supports the idea of concept formation. Pigeons apparently are able to generate a concept of tree. Different types of trees, pine trees, spruce trees, aspens, poplars, whatever they are, they have some sort of tree concept. So it's not based on memorization, it's conceptual. Do pigeons think about trees the same way that we do? That's a tough one. Here's another study that Herrnstein did. In this case, he said, go out and get me pictures of cars, go out and get me pictures of people and no people. So people will be the positive instance, no people, the negative instance. If you respond in the presence of people, you get reinforced. If you respond in the presence of no people, you do not get reinforced. Everything's going great, goes through the training, shows them another 40 pictures with people, novel pictures, another 40 pictures with no people. And everything's going well except for one picture. It's a picture of a car. No people. Pigeons are all responding to it. So Herrnstein calls his grad students in, and it's like, what's this a picture of? When your supervisor is asking you a really stupidly blatant question, right? And it's like, it looks like a car. Is this a trick question? You know, is this going to come up in my PhD defense? So what's happening here? It's like, a car? Damn straight it's a car. Why is it that the pigeons are responding to it? Really like VW bugs? I don't know. Somebody finally looked at the picture carefully and went, and said, oh yeah, I took that picture. Oh hey, there I am. I'm reflected in the window. There's this blurry, distorted image of the photographer, camera in front of face, in the window. The pigeons go, there's a person. They've learned. You respond to people. That's a person. It's a kind of flat, thin, wavy person. Definitely a person. Go for it. So they can generate concepts, but they're not necessarily exactly the same as how, I mean, we wouldn't say, oh, that's a person. It's like, that's a reflection of a person. From the pigeon's point of view, it's like, yeah, person. Close enough. Yeah, actually, you know, we'll not progress at this point. So just reminder. Next class, I'll be here at 9:45 instead of 10. I will bring the midterms. We'll have your answer sheets, and I'll put the keys up so you can go through and look at those. I will be here after class a bit longer, so I'll hang around until, say, 2:15. And so if you can't make it before, feel free, hang around after, take a look at things. If you can't make it after, maybe you can come before. Can't do either, we'll see what we can work out. But you'll have a chance to look at your midterm, see how you did there. Grades are up. There's a couple of people that had late assignments come in. I haven't got those grades in because I just got them today. But everything else, the grades are up for 3 assignments and the midterm. So I will stop this, and then I'll go lay out the third assignment so you can pick up your third assignment.